In the United States, most religious traditions and denominations and congregations follow some form of participatory decision-making for at least part of their organizational decisions. Yet our Unitarian Universalist Association has the distinction of listing the practice of democracy as an official religious value. On our list of Unitarian Universalist principles, it is number 5. We affirm the right of conscience. We promote the use of the democratic process in our congregations and in society at large. Hence, it seems fitting on this Sunday before Independence Day to reflect on the health of U.S. American democracy. It seems even more urgent right now when a new presidential administration counts among its fans many who are avowed opponents of democratic ideals. Such ideals include unity amid pluralism, equality under the law, vigorous debate and honorable disagreement, liberty from coercion by the state, freedom of the press, respect for the separate branches of government, and limits on executive power. Leaders of the so-called alt-right movement reject these values, and they are open about it. One alt-right leader is Stephen K. Bannon, a chief advisor to President Donald Trump. Bannon's goal, he said, is the deconstruction of the administrative state. By this, he means the bureaucracy that puts our laws into action. As with Donald Trump, Stephen Bannon did not rise through the ranks of government service or the military or even the ranks of the Republican Party. At age 63, he came directly from operating Breitbart News, which is not really a news organization. Breitbart rejects any standards of accountable journalism. In pursuit of power and confusion, it promotes lies and misunderstanding. In late January, once he was in his position, Bannon launched the president's ban on refugees from Syria and on immigrants from 6 other majority Muslim countries, even after they had been vetted and approved. Families fleeing violence found themselves desperate and stranded at their airports or sent home from foreign airports. In widespread shock at that action, many Americans went to airports around this country to protest the ban and to say, "We welcome you to families fleeing persecution." Citizens let Congress know that they saw the ban as wrong, irrational, and cruel. Federal courts blocked the ban as unconstitutional in February. After some revisions, however, another ban has just now gone into effect. Many of the followers of the alt-right like to sport symbols of fascism, sometimes trendy haircuts that recall the Nazi style, but also Nazi SS insignias. At an alt-right election victory party, where Trump was not present, people in the crowd made the Nazi salute to shouts of "Hail Trump, hail our people, hail victory." These folks believe, as did the Nazis, that the proper leaders of Western civilization are white, European-descended males. While they come out of a Christian background, some of the alt-right leaders are secular or atheist. Christianity, as it is practiced now, is too diverse for them. They feel that Christianity surrendered and gave up running civilization. Yet the alt-right people keep the worst of the legacy of Christian imperialism, including anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim hatred. They are openly bigoted against people of color and feminists. This goes even for women who speak for the alt-right, and there are some. They ignore that it was the agitation of early American feminists that was the main reason that they have a platform from which they can now condemn others. The ideology of the alt-right movement is clearly articulated by Richard Spencer, a white man in his mid-40s. He is the head of a white identity think tank in Washington, D.C. It's called the National Policy Institute. Spencer founded Alternative Right, an online magazine. Spencer believes that white liberal men have decided to commit civilizational suicide by giving up their proper place as lords of humanity. These are his words. To be white is to be a striver, a crusader, an explorer, and a conqueror. We build, we produce, we go upward. For us, it is conquer or die. Our fate is entirely in our hands. This is the great struggle we are called to. We are not meant to live in shame and weakness and disgrace. We were not meant to beg for moral validation from some of the most despicable creatures ever to populate the planet. We were meant to overcome all of it, because for us, as Europeans, it is only normal again when we are great again. End of quotation. Against his words, putting white, European-descended males at the top of the human hierarchy, let us hear some words of the American founders. The Declaration of Independence says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." In other words, our founding American document proclaims universal human rights. It is not the declaration of a crusade or a conquest, but a promise of equality and freedom for all people. To be sure, U.S. history since the beginning has been full of struggles and setbacks. We are still on our way to a full recognition and practice of those human rights. Yet the leaders of the alt-right condemn those rights. There is nothing patriotic about their language or platform. Patriotism celebrates national accomplishments for the benefit of everyone. Patriotism appeals to our sense of shared achievements, aspirations, and love of the founding values of this nation. Gary Dorian is a minister and a professor of theology and social ethics at Union Seminary in New York City. Dorian says, "Patriots want the nation to live up to its ideals, which means asking us to be our best selves." And that is what we sang earlier. America, America, God mend thine every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law. What we hear from the alt-right and from the White House right now is not patriotism, but nationalism. Nationalism appeals to grudges and resentments and a sense of exceptionalism rather than a sense of common humanity. Nationalism appeals to the lust for victory and revenge. In U.S. history, leaders from various political parties have said that their policies and their platforms were congruent with American values, with the U.S. Constitution. No matter which policies they were promoting, they made that argument. And the scary thing about the alt-right is that they see no need to appeal to democratic values. They think democracy is a failure, and it should be replaced. It is weak, and we need a strong hand. Donald Trump has promised to be that strong hand. Historian Timothy Snyder says that this president basically never says he supports democracy. The president has never given any indication that he understands or respects the rule of law. In Snyder's recent book, On Tyranny, he compares the words and actions of the current administration to those words and actions of several Central European and Eastern European countries in the 20th century, countries that became totalitarian states. For example, Soviet and Nazi power grabs took place in times of economic dislocation and fear, using rhetoric that scapegoated certain groups as the source of people's pain. Democracy and freedom were taken, stolen. Actually, Snyder says, people gave up their freedoms freely. In fear, and perhaps with relief that someone else promised to solve their problems, many people surrendered their values quite willingly. For this reason, Snyder gives us this warning: do not obey in advance. This piece of advice is one of Snyder's 20 lessons to live by in these times. He says, if you care about the health of democracy, do not obey in advance. And he says, be calm when bad things happen. Don't panic and fall into conformity. Don't give up your values. In 1933, Adolf Hitler was elected democratically as Germany's chancellor. 1 month later, the Reichstag, or Germany's parliament building, was destroyed in an arson fire. Civil liberties were suspended. Nazi-controlled newspapers called the fire a communist plot. The parliament included elected members from the Communist Party, and the Nazis had those Communist Party members in parliament arrested, thereby giving the Nazis a new majority in parliament. And this enabled them to take power indefinitely. Timothy Snyder fears that our government leaders would like to exploit a crisis here. I do too. Whether it's a financial crash, a terrorist attack, or a made-up story about a plot against the country, the government could jail its critics, take away civil liberties, and suspend elections. For this reason, do not obey in advance, and be calm when bad things happen. We need you to be calm. Another of Snyder's 20 lessons for these times is defend institutions. Be vigilant in supporting government agencies and the court system. Protect and support independent organizations, especially when they advocate for transparency at any level of government. The stakes may not seem as high when leaders of smaller public institutions hide things, but it is still a loss of the transparency that we count on in a democracy. And here's a local example. In May, Sacramento State University's student newspaper, The Hornet, published a story and graphics about the state auditor's report on the discrepancy between the high salaries of university administrators and the pay of other staff at the university, including professors and hourly workers. A student reporter asked the university for historical data about pay increases for these several categories. A spokesperson for the school refused. She said the student newspaper would need to file a California Open Records request to get the information. So the newspaper filed one, but at press time, it had received no answer. What a way to treat your own students. They are learning how to be journalists at a public university, and you are supposed to serve them. Of course, when it comes to the news media, it seems everyone has a gripe with some aspect of news coverage, locally or nationally or internationally. I often have a gripe with something or another, yet critiques and complaints about the press are part of the territory. When you have a free press, it's messy and people make mistakes. Yet I don't want the press to get any weaker. I just want it to continue being vigorous and being accountable. The current White House and its allies have lied to the press, refused to answer questions, and dismissed factual revelations as fake news. Timothy Snyder asserts, "Fascism says that what you or I experience as facts or what reporters uncover as facts are not relevant. All that matters are impressions and emotions and myths." Richard Spencer, the alt-right leader, has invoked the German word Lügenpresse to dismiss independent media. I may not have pronounced it right, but it's a German word that the Nazis used under Hitler, and it means the lying press. If we don't protect institutions, if we don't protect the institutions of democracy, how will they protect us? Among his other lessons for supporting democracy in these times, Snyder urges contribute to good causes. He adds also that you must get involved in your community. Don't be isolated. Meet people face to face. Make small talk. He says, don't think that Facebook is a substitute for knowing people in person. Conversation with flesh and blood neighbors in real spaces takes more effort than connecting in virtual spaces, but it's important. Let office holders and public officials know that you are paying attention, and pay attention. This is how we embody another of his 20 lessons. Be patriotic. Show your love of country, or city, or state by showing up. It is a paradox of democracy that democracy gives us the liberty to be left alone, the freedom to not participate in voting, discussing, reading about, or keeping an eye on those in office. Yet for its health and survival, democracy depends on our participation. Not everybody's vigilance is necessary all the time, but the more we have of it, the better. Be patriotic. His final advice for these times is this: be as courageous as you can. During the Republican primaries of 2016, former Republican Governor Mitt Romney made a speech to argue why Trump should not get the nomination. Romney laid out Trump's failures, lies, and alleged violations of laws. Romney perhaps waited too long to have an impact, or perhaps other party leaders should have shown as much courage to say what they thought as he showed. Yet in the days and months since the election, millions of ordinary people have shown courage. They have shown up together to protect their immigrant neighbors from government force and to protect their Muslim neighbors from harassment and violence. They have shown up for the dignity of women and for their safety. They have shown up to insist on the use of science to debate public policy. Before this year, many of those people had never participated in a protest march, including some folks from this congregation. Of course, the United States is not the only place where people show courage in defense of democracy. For example, yesterday in Hong Kong, on the 20th anniversary of Hong Kong's transfer as a colony of the United Kingdom to China, people demonstrated for democracy. Last March, in South Korea, ordinary people held candlelight vigils on city streets. Night after night, they protested the corruption of the South Korean president, whom they had elected 5 years earlier. They had one more vigil as they waited for the South Korean Supreme Court to rule. And unanimously, the judges impeached the president and removed her from office, to the cheering of crowds outside the court. But in any democracy, not everybody cheers or boos at the same thing. In Korea, there is a vigorous and ongoing debate on many issues. Among other sights I saw on my recent journey there was an encampment outside the city hall in Seoul. With a phone, I took a picture and sent it, a picture of the many tents and banners and flags and signs of this pretty well-established encampment. I sent it to a Korean friend in Berkeley, and he wrote me back, "Now you are seeing the other end of the spectrum of Korean politics." These were not the candlelight vigil folks. These people liked the president who had been impeached. In English, one of their banners said, "Let's protect our democracy. We must prevent our country from being overthrown by the National Assembly, the press, and the courts." Well, I thought, that's exactly how a democracy is intended to work, with the legislature, courts, and president all held accountable, thanks to a free press and the freedom to assemble and speak out. Lessons for these times. Do not obey in advance. Stay calm when bad things happen. Defend institutions and people. Contribute to good causes. Show up face to face. Be patriotic and pay attention. Be as courageous as you can. Democracy is messy, often tense and contentious, and sometimes quite slow. In this country, it was set up to be this way intentionally in the Constitution. And even under the Constitution, this nation is not perfect. Democracy never will be. If perfection were its measure, democracy never would have made it this far. I cannot be sure that democracy will endure, but I do have faith that it will. Perhaps by our vigilance in these times, we will make democracy stronger. We will make this truth more strongly self-evident, that all people indeed are created equal. Democracy needs to be tended to, cared for. We must care for it even when it fails to embody the best of its potential. Whatever our political party, political opinion, or background, we who value democracy must stay connected for our sake and for the sake of the generations who will come after us. We must stay connected. We can protect the practice of democracy by practicing democracy. We can protect one another and our democracy by being as courageous as we can. So may it be. Blessed be, and amen.